They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Hello, and welcome back to Magellan's at the Movies, brought to you by tobacco, payday loans, and the good people over at the military-industrial complex.
Not crypto?
I thought about doing crypto. But we'll get there. We've got our feelers out, right? Our people are talking with their people.
Yep.
I'm your host, Elliot Mogulyans. I'm joined by Nathan Mogulyans, your also host. Nathan, Stranger Things Season 5. Volume 1 of 3 is here, whether you like it or not,
yep.
And plenty of people do like it. Most people do like it. The overwhelming majority of people like it.
Hmm.
I have seen the first, 4 episodes?
Yeah, 4, I think.
Yeah, with one of them, I didn't even realize this, directed by Frank Darabont. That's interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
I didn't notice. When I watched the episode, I wasn't like, oh wow, that's like how Frank Darabont films his movies. But so consensus is that this is good. Just like Stranger Things is always enjoyable.
Yeah.
I have to say I am a little mixed.
Mm.
And of course, there's the obvious caveat that this is just the first 4 episodes. So It's not great that you're feeling mixed when the season is halfway done, but still, There's a chance for a comeback. I just think it's interesting as I've been thinking about it, because I watched this all with the family on the day that it came out.
Yeah.
We're a family of Stranger Things fans,
mm-hmm.
or at least mom and dad are.
Yeah.
And I think Ryan's into it. But ever since then, I've been thinking about it, I've come to the conclusion that there's a lot of flanderization going on in this show, both in the characters and also the show itself. Like, it's the Stranger Things style is kind of flanderizing.
Mm.
Different characters are in different stages. Some of them are pretty consistent. I think Eleven has been pretty consistent across the entire show.
Yeah.
But, like, Hopper is just a completely different beast from season 1. Robin, I really don't like Robin, and she is...
Dang.
She is in, I don't know, stage 3 flanderization. But yeah, just the mixture of lighthearted, almost irreverent, not irreverent, but there's a certain Devil May Care energy to the show at times, that is mixed with something more sober and more serious, something as serious as, right, a single mother losing one of her children. I think all the way back to season 1. And I feel like the mixture has just never, they've never nailed it like they did in season 1. And at this point, as the show falls ever more victim to scope creep, because like we are just, it is just out of control at this point in terms of how many like, or just the scale of the threat and the power levels involved. It's the point I'm making is that it's a completely different show to the one that started it all.
Yeah.
And I just, for my money, I think that it peaked with season one. That's not to say that I didn't enjoy parts of it, because I did. And I'll still see it through. But I think that on the whole, the show is... it's just kind of... I don't know. There's almost a sense that it's bought into its own hype at this point. Mm. That's like Stranger Things is funny and kooky, and it combines Stephen King with Steven Spielberg, and there's horror and humor and all kinds of stuff. And they're like, yes, and yes, and yes, and just throwing it all into this. Well, all right. I'm done talking. That's all I have to say about the show.
I do think, I haven't seen it yet, so I'd love to share my actual thoughts on it, but I do think flanderization, or for people who aren't on the up and up with TV show nomenclature, just the gradual heightening of one character quality that a character is kind of known for at the cost of removing other qualities for the character, the classic example being Ned Flanders from The Simpsons becoming more and more ridiculous and silly instead of the fairly grounded character he is in the beginning. I do think it's an especially difficult thing to keep a character grounded, especially in a show like Stranger Things, where there is that heightened sense from the Steven Spielberg and kind of even the Stephen King halves of that conceit, that Spielberg movies are always a little bit heightened, characters are a little bit more drawn with broad strokes than something like someone like I can't come up with another great movie director who makes very specific characters. Well, Martin McDonagh, I guess I would say. But it is tough to keep out that sort of thing. So maybe I'll end up watching this final season. It's such an odd thing. I feel like every time I think about Stranger Things, I forget that there's four seasons. Like, a part of me feels like there should be and there has been fewer seasons, but there have been four and now five. So I don't know. In other more related to us news, it is the tail end of the year. We are building up people. I've already seen dozens of end of the year lists, people ranking their favorite movies from the year. I've seen some great lists. I've seen some terrible lists. I've seen some lists with everything in between. We are building towards our lists, our final survey of the year. Very excited for that episode. Got some movies I'm very excited to watch as we build toward this. Hamnet, I'm hoping to see this weekend. Sentimental Value, I'm hoping to see. No Other Choice, I'm really hoping, shows anywhere within 200 miles of me, but I don't have a ton of hope on that. So we're going to be talking about movies from the year, our favorite movies from the year, as we move forward in time. Otherwise, Elliot, let's just jump into...
Well, hold on a second. Oh,
never mind.
Because I have to say, we have to issue a correction. That in our last episode, I recommended movie... 48 Hours, but I described the movie Midnight Run. And if you were confused, which you have every right to be, I was trying to recommend Midnight Run. I don't really have any like, oh, I was drunk or I was tired or anything. I'm just stupid is the problem. And the funny thing is, I went back and listened to it, and I said, when I was describing the movie, I was like, oh, Robert De Niro has to get this guy to someplace within 48 hours. Like, in my head, Midnight Run absorbed characteristics of 48 hours.
Yeah.
And so I was just all over the place. But yeah, I do like 48 hours. And I'd even, I been thinking about recommending it, which is probably why I ended up saying it. But no, yeah. I was trying to say Midnight Run. That was the movie.
That's so funny. It's funny, too, because afterwards, both of us admitted to thinking about correcting or, like, saying something about it, because I noticed that you were talking about 48 Hours and didn't mention, like, Eddie Murphy, and I even opened a new tab and Googled the movie and was like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't... Like, I didn't know Robert De Niro was in that. That's so funny. And I just didn't say anything. So it is, yeah, a failure for both of us, I'd say. We were both somewhat culpable. That's funny. But anyway, let's talk about the movie we're reviewing today. We're talking about a bit of a 90s... Well, actually, it was released in the 80s, so that's my bad. 80s classic for children. We're talking about The Land Before Time. Elliot, you picked this one. Give us the rundown. Why'd you pick it? And let's get this started.
Oh, man, yeah. Land Before Time, directed by Don Bluth, a man of some renown in animation. when did this come out? Let's see. The Land Before Time.
1988.
Wow. There's a TV show or something. Yep. You can watch entire episodes on YouTube.
Yeah.
So there you go. Anyway, we're talking about where it all began in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
With this movie directed by Don Bluth, produced by Spielberg and Lucas. I didn't even know. But yeah, in terms of foundational childhood movies, this one's up there. Before, I would watch Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles every single time I went to my grandparents' house. I would watch The Land Before Time every single time I went to my grandparents' house. So, yeah, this is a movie that's not particularly well thought of critically, but I think a lot of people are familiar with this movie. A lot of people grew up watching it. It's very well known. It's very popular. It's got like 13 sequels or something like that, none of which had the involvement of Bluth or Spielberg or Lucas or anyone. But yeah, we're here to talk about this original one. If you didn't know, it's an animated movie about a group of misfit dinosaur children who have to overcome their differences and go on a journey across a changing prehistoric Earth in search of a place, in search of food, because the food is all dying. So they need to find the Great Valley.
The Great Valley.
I've forgotten already.
Yes.
Yeah, the Great Valley, where everyone can eat their fill of grass and drink their fill of water, and predators don't even exist, because in this movie, the predators, all the dinosaurs are sentient except the predators. The T-Rexes are, like, in this world, snarling Neanderthals or something. But yeah, so that's the setup. Let's just get right into it. Nathan, what did you think about this movie? And also, how long has it been since you've seen this? Because I was thinking, like, it's got to be over a decade since I last watched this.
Well, funnily enough, I actually watched this earlier this year because it was free on some streaming service, and my wife had also seen it as a child. And so we watched it as a fun little trip down memory lane. So I think before that, yeah, it would have had to have been over a decade, because I remembered very little, in the sense that before watching the movie, if you had asked me to describe the plot, I would not have been able to tell you much. But as soon as the movie started and my brain was being fed, right, the images that would trigger memories, I was like, oh, yeah, I remember this. I remember Spike coming out of his shell and, you know, chomping all of the grass around his egg or whatever. So it had been a bit. The other thing that I remember about going to our grandparents to see it is those 13 sequels. I feel like every time we would go, or very often when we would go to grandma and grandpa's, they would have the new Land Before Time movie that they had the collection. I want to say they had all 12, because the 14th, or all 12 sequels, because the 13th sequel was released in 2016. So by then, I don't think they were still getting them for us. But I feel like almost all of, I've seen most of the sequels of this. But anyway, talking about this one, I think it's a pretty fun movie. I think in the pantheon of movies you watch as a kid and then revisit, I think this is probably on the higher end in terms of quality. It's not like The Incredibles or Finding Nemo, which are movies that I think I return to with a greater and greater appreciation every time I rewatch them. But I do think it's better than, I'm trying to think of something really terrible we watched as a kid.
Despicable Me.
Dang, that wasn't like, we didn't revisit that one though. I don't know. Maybe it's just the movies other people watched as a kid. Like, I saw Fern Gully recently. Not good. Not enjoyable. But if I had seen it as a kid, maybe I would really like it. So, yeah. I don't know how illuminating that is for my full thoughts on the movie, but I think it's decent. I think it's a pretty good movie.
Yeah, I agree. I'm in much the same place. I almost feel like this is a really strong first draft of a movie, because it's very brief. It's like an hour and 8 minutes.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is stuff that is not moving the plot forward, right? It's just sort of like the camera sweeping through prehistoric landscapes and showing the audience interesting stuff, right?
Mm.
Keeping the attention of children.
Mm.
But there is a lot that I enjoy about this movie, and at the end of the day, I feel very similar to the way I felt after Tron Legacy, where I was like, the biggest problem with this movie is that I just wanted more. I feel like there was potential. This movie did not live up to its fullest potential, which is harsh, but I still enjoyed it. I thought the animation was really good. What is this anime? This is Cell Animation, right?
Yeah, I think so. Don't quote me on that, animation nerds, but I think it is, yeah.
Well, I really like it. I think it's neat. It's charming.
Yeah.
And at times, not beautiful in like a striking way, like, I don't know, the view of the Rockies would be beautiful, but I don't know, something warm and comforting about it, although that may just be nostalgia, right? But I think that it is beautiful in its own way. I thought that the very young actors did a very good job.
Yeah.
Obviously with kid actors it's a bit of a gamble, but I thought that they were not called upon to do anything particularly taxing, and so I was never taken out of the movie of like, okay, this is a child reading lines from a script.
Yeah.
There were I remembered less of this movie than I thought. And there were times, a lot of it I didn't remember so much as just that. This is so hard to describe. It's honestly stupid to even try. But like,
great.
Parts of the movie would happen, and I would have some kind of like deep emotional reaction to it that I didn't understand. And I think it was like a vestige. It was like a memory of a memory of a memory. Like when Littlefoot's mother dies, I just had this weird sensation of feeling like this is really sad, but I'm not sure why. Because it's not super well done. It's not the most well done thing in the movie, but I think as a child, I might have been devastated by this. This is weird, but the thing that was most evocative for me was honestly the old Universal logo that I was just, as I watched it, I was just struck by the sudden and total, just like this bracing realization of, oh, this is what I know the Universal logo from. This is what I attach to the Universal logo, to the song and the little graphic. It is the Land Before Time. But that's neither here nor there. The point of all this rambling, I do so much rambling, is that I enjoyed it. And I just wanted more.
Yeah. I do think I wrote in my notes, because I feel much the same way as you, that some of the strongest pieces of this movie are when it's largely dialogue-free scenes of the kids interacting with their parents, or just the environment interacting with itself. I think that opening sequence where there's some narration, but otherwise it's a lot of Littlefoot with his mom and his grandparents, and that sequence where she dies. Yeah, I don't think it's like the greatest thing ever, but I think it's really well done. And this is another case too where you remember more of our childhood than I do. I don't know, I must have been in a fugue state until I turned 14 or something, because I don't remember being that particularly upset by Littlefoot's mother dying. And certainly when I watched it this time, I was just like, oh, this is one of those classic children's movies that has a parent dying and has a fairly tough scene, I guess you could say, of the child with the parent's corpse. You think of, like, The Lion King is one of the famous examples of just a crazy scene to subject on a child, I would say. But yeah, I think it's the strongest moments for me are these kind of dialogue-free moments. I think of two when the pterodactyls are, like, fighting over the berry or whatever.
Dude, when he offers Littlefoot the berry, that is the cutest flipping thing I've ever seen in my life.
That's another moment that I remember as a kid really enjoying and finding a lot of fun in. It kind of reminded me of, I haven't watched all of this show, but Genndy Tartakovsky's Primal, which is a dialogue-free, I believe, the episodes I saw didn't have any dialogue, or maybe had narration in the beginning or something, but otherwise it's all communicated via kind of grunts and just context clues of things. And I find that storytelling method to be very compelling, and I don't, every time in this movie where the characters are talking or the characters are doing things, I feel less engaged than when it's just Sarah finding the T-Rex at the bottom of the gorge and then it waking up and attacking her. Like, that's such a fantastic sequence because it's all communicated without dialogue and just with tension and the music and all of these other pieces.
Yeah, I agree. I think that imagine if this entire movie had no dialogue.
Well, that's according to
the dinosaurs weren't even like,
yeah,
they weren't, I mean, they were clearly anthropomorphized to a certain extent, but they never talked. That would have been great.
Yeah. According to the IMDb. Oh.
Go ahead.
According to the IMDb trivia, that was the original conceit, but then they had to change it.
Cowards.
Well.
Well, I mean, clearly they kept a lot from that original idea, because a lot of that is still there in those sequences, like when the pterodons, not pterodactyls.
Oh my goodness.
I only know that because I saw it on the Wikipedia page.
Oh my gosh.
When they're doing their thing with the, I don't know what it is, but it looks, it's one of those fictional cartoon foods where you're like, oh, that looks good.
That does look good.
I would take that. Even if my mother had just died, I'd be like, oh, shoot, thanks. I'm going to eat that. Well, I don't know. Yeah, so that sequence, the stuff with Sarah finding the T-Rex, the fight between the mother and the T-Rex, which happens a lot in Shadow.
Yep.
Littlefoot's birth, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's all very good. It's like the first half or like first quarter, I don't know, of WALL-E. When it's mostly him just puddling around in the trash heaps.
Yeah.
But it's very good. And I think that I don't dislike the stuff with dialogue. I still think that it's charming. I think that the movie suffers from too many characters. Because, like, when Spike was introduced, I was like, all right, I don't think we need this. And indeed, he doesn't really contribute anything. Because he doesn't talk, he doesn't seem to have, he seems to be less sentient than the other
He's
children.
A baby.
I guess that's true. He seems very sentient for a baby. But, yeah, I just thought at that point we had Littlefoot, Sarah is kind of on the outskirts of this little group, Ducky. What's the pterodon's name?
Petrie,
yeah. And I was kind of like, I was satisfied with that group. I thought we've got the sort of nominative leader, the combative one, the funny one, the most childish one. I was satisfied with that. But then we get Spike in here. And in a movie this brief, I have to wonder if maybe they just needed to fill time. With Spike, but it is a neat thing to watch him eat all that grass when he hatches.
I like how he, there's one shot where he gives the grass a look like, oh, I'm gonna sneak up, like, I didn't realize there was more grass, I'm gonna sneak up on this. And there's just something very satisfying about the way he chomps all of it up.
Absolutely. But I think that, and in a lot of ways, because this movie is clearly made for very young children. So in a lot of ways, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to say, why are these characters not more complex? But I was just thinking that the conflict between Littlefoot and Sarah is, I think, a good one. And it makes sense for a kid's movie because the dinosaurs are racist. And Sarah needs to learn to overcome her racism.
Yeah.
And I guess when she gets back, when she reunites with her family, she's going to have to deconvert her father from the Church of Racism. Which, good luck with that.
Yeah.
But I just think, right, that's a good message that makes sense for children. Maybe if it was more fleshed out, maybe if it was more present, it would just kind of be distracting or it wouldn't really register with kids. I think there may have been room for something a little more in depth. But again, as with a lot of my critiques of the movie or the things that I didn't like about the movie, I still found their conflict to be satisfying, and I felt happy that Sarah overcame racism and was part of the group. And right, I've said it again and again, but people learning to overcome their differences and becoming friends, that's just a shortcut right into my heart. We're kind of all over the place here, but
yeah.
Yeah, Nathan, you say something.
No, I agree. I do think it was crazy to me. Yeah, that the dinosaurs are racist. That's ridiculous, I guess.
Unlike human racism, which makes complete sense.
Don't put words into my mouth. Yeah, I do think... I don't know. I agree with you on a lot of this stuff. And the movie's just... It's an hour long. There's not a ton to talk about here. And for the most part, the movie is doing everything decently, but not amazingly. Again, like I said at the outset, it's not a movie that you return to and your perspective is different and suddenly the movie just opens up in a whole new way for you. Like, again, Ratatouille, I even think kind of, I was thinking of like Zootopia, which is also a movie kind of about racism that I think has more to chew on for an adult as well as more to chew on for like a child. I think it's more aggressive in its plotting of, oh, these people are being judged for something they can't control and something that, you know, no one should be judged for, and kind of teasing out the idea of that. And yeah, the characters in here, they're decent. I would agree with you. There's more than I think is necessary. You've got the great classic Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles setup already. You don't need to introduce... Actually, isn't Spike the name of the, like, fifth turtle or whatever? Isn't Spike the name of the turtle that Raph has that becomes another Mutant Ninja Turtle?
What are you referring to?
Am I imagining? There's a fifth in... A lot of the TMNT stuff, there's like a fifth turtle who is Raphael's pet turtle who gets hit with the mutagen and becomes a fifth Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. Although usually he's like more combative, so he's not with them all the time. But I thought his name was Spike.
Oh, well, there's definitely... You are right. It looks like... In the 2012 animated series?
Yeah.
He has one. Is that the one that we watched?
Yes.
We watched more than one. What? Raphael is voiced by Sean Astin in this?
That's crazy.
What the heck?
We're way off the road now.
That is insane. Yeah, but you are right. He has Spike.
Yes.
He mutates and becomes... Slash.
Oh, Slash. That's so funny.
Sean Astin. It's the Sean Astin.
From Stranger Things, season 2.
Exactly, yeah.
My favorite Sean Astin movie. Anyway, apologies for the side route being... back to the movie, Learning Before Time. Yeah, the characters are all decent. I think it does just feel like a movie for a younger audience than even something... Well, I don't know about that. But it feels like it's for a younger audience than even something like Finding Nemo, which is clearly for a young audience, but there still needs to be some grasp of other pieces, whereas The Land Before Time just has a lot of quirky characters saying funny things in a funny way. We got Petrie unable to fly, squeaky high voice. We got Ducky saying yep, yep, yep all the time and such. And then we have Sarah and Littlefoot kind of being competing. And then Spike is just there because he's a baby. So yeah, I feel like the log line for me is just, it's all decently done. It's a movie I wouldn't refuse to show like my children or something, but it's not a movie I would ever necessarily pick to watch in general, the way I would pick to watch like Up or something like that.
Yeah, it's not a movie that sort of expands to accommodate age upon rewatch. Although I do think that there's one section where I was like, this is actually not something that I think children would necessarily understand, but I appreciate its inclusion. After Littlefoot's mother dies and he encounters Rooter,
yes,
who then vanishes from the movie for some reason, I don't know. But Rooter is initially somewhat brusque with Littlefoot, and Littlefoot reveals that his mother died, and he blames her for it, that for being, for attacking the T-Rex or something, which is a bit revisionist from my memory.
Yeah.
But Rooter says, like, it wasn't her fault, it's not your fault. Sometimes things happen that are nobody's fault, and you just need to, right? It's something that you need to come to terms with. And I really liked that. I liked that moment, because I thought that was, like I said, it's not something that I think children would necessarily grasp, would even be capable of grasping. But it is a strong message, and it's the kind of message that you would see even in more adult-oriented movies. I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but the idea that embracing catastrophic or even traumatic events, not embracing them, but accepting that they are not the product of personal decisions, that some things just happen, sometimes bad things just happen, that is something that you would expect to find in a more mature movie. Obviously, it wouldn't be as simplistic as that, but yeah.
You know who Rooter kind of reminded me of? He reminded me of, I think it's Judd Hirsch's character in The Fablements, the, like, uncle who comes to stay with them.
I know who you're talking about. I don't remember him. How does he remind you of that?
It feels like he looks like Judd Hirsch, and the sense of some outsider gives you advice that you kind of need at that juncture in your life. It feels the same. I don't know. Just something about it felt very much like that character. And Spielberg producing, I was like, dude, he put him in the movie. That's my headcanon.
What is your headcanon? You cut out there for a second.
My headcanon is that Steven Spielberg wrote this character thinking of his uncle, just like he wrote Judd Hirsch in Fablements.
That could very well be. Just switching gears here a little bit, I think that the T-Rex, for some reason, I remember there being two of them.
I think maybe you're thinking of a sequel where there's two, or...
Yeah, you're probably right.
Shoot, now I'm trying to think of the movie too. I know where you're where they're like, they're chased by one dinosaur, and then at the end they're like, oh shoot, both of them are There was actually two.
The movie Dinosaur?
Yeah, was it Dinosaur?
I think it might have been. Because that movie ends with, I think they're like Allosauruses or... No, they're not Allosauruses. Dang. Some kind of predatory dinosaur.
We gotta review end, Dinosaur.
That movie's insane. I would love to rewatch it. Literally, the only parts I remember about it are at the beginning with the meteors and the end with the whatever they are, bad dinosaurs. But anyway, the T-Rex, I think, is a really good antagonist for a kid's movie. And even the logic is very childlike, that the herbivores are, I mean, in some way it's kind of right, a little bit racist that the T-Rex is a mindless savage beast, but who knows, maybe this T-Rex is insane, right? He has some kind of clinical mental illness, and there's a colony of Rexes somewhere else who are like, man, has anyone seen Steve since he went crazy? Probably. I hope he doesn't hurt anyone. but maybe not. The point is that I think that the T-Rex works as an antagonist in a kid's movie because it is scary, right? It's black. Its eyes are orange. It looks like it has the eye of Sauron.
Yeah.
I thought that it was a good antagonist. Your classic force of nature antagonist. And I think that it's the kind of antagonist that may have really scared me as a child. Or certainly one of the, aside from the Universal logo, one of the clearest memories I had of the movie going into it was of Sarah charging at the incapacitated Rex and it opening its eye, which I think may have impacted me somewhat as a child.
Yeah, I agree. I think, again, the strongest points of this movie are the style of it. That, yeah, the animation is very effective. The animation of the T-Rex is very effective. I think the music is very effective at conveying tone. This is the stuff that I love about movies, that I'm like, visuals and sound is the fundamental building blocks of film. And all you really need to start to convey emotion and story and plot and characters, and it's just so well done. I think all of the animation in this movie is so fun to watch. Again, like the stuff of Spike eating the grass, that it's so well characterized that it's just a fun, it's like playing a great video game where sometimes it's just fun to see an animation, or just fun to trigger an animation because you're like, dang, that's so satisfying, that's so well done. And I don't know, it's kind of like when we're talking about good cinematography, I don't know what in it is making it good. All I can say is my reaction to watching it is like, dang, that was fun. I love watching that.
Yeah, that's the other thing about the animation, is that the characters are really good. There's really good facial emoting by the characters. Mm. It's all very exaggerated, but like when Littlefoot and Sarah have a fight and the Littlefoot loses it because he's right. Sarah's a Triceratops.
Yeah.
She's a little bit more suited to fighting.
Yeah.
But his expression, it's hard to describe, but I was like, yeah, that's what a kid looks when he's trying really hard not to cry.
Yeah.
I bet I've made that expression many times as a child. I was often
almost crying,
mistreated and harassed by my peers.
Harassed?
Yeah, absolutely. And I had to put on a brave face, right? Be the good soldier.
Uh-huh.
Carry on, yeah.
That's weird. That's not how I remember you being as a child.
Well, you said you don't remember anything about our childhood.
Well,
you were in a fugue state.
What little I do remember, I do not remember you putting on a brave face. Anyway, this is going to be our last episode forever. We're breaking up because we keep bullying each other. Anyway, I don't really have any other thoughts or notes here for this movie, so we could get to a rating if you're ready.
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right. Well, like I said, actually, I had forgotten about that scene with Trotter. That is also a good scene. So I'm bumping my score up.
Trotter?
Oh, shoot. What did you say his name was?
Rooter. Rooter. Yeah.
All right. That's my bad. I had really forgotten about that scene. I even forgot the character's name 2 minutes after you said it. But I think the good scenes in this movie are genuinely very good. And the stuff in between isn't so bad to really drag down the score that much. I'm giving it a 7.6 out of 10.
It was a Land Before Time video game.
Yeah. It's a whole media franchise, Elliot.
I didn't know.
They're making money.
This says Littlefoot's father's name is Braun.
Yeah, for some reason, Littlefoot's father, yeah, I guess shows up later in the series. I don't know what he's doing during this movie, faffing about.
He's just out for cigarettes.
Yeah, he's out getting milk. And then his wife dies, and then he shows up again. I don't know how they explain it. Maybe we need to watch all other 13 movies to figure it out.
Maybe it's a 2D platformer.
All right. Anyway, what's your rating, Elliot?
Play any one of the main characters.
That's okay. Nice.
I mean, I pretty much already summed it up with this movie's a lot like Tron Legacy, that it's a really strong foundation, and I enjoyed lots of it. I can see that there was potential for more. And also, if anyone wants to remake this movie, do it without dialogue. I think that would be great. That would be fantastic. I would go see that in the theaters. But yeah, I think the animation is lovely. The performances are good. There's not a whole lot to say against this movie, aside from there's just potential left on the table. So I'm going to give it a B-, which is the rating that I gave Tron Legacy.
All right. Well, then let's take this to recommendations. I was kind of juggling a couple of different recommendations, but I've gone to, I think, the obvious one. This is, as this year is closing up, this was one of my top five favorite movies from last year. It has received a Criterion release, so if you want to get it physically, it's easier than ever to see it.
Wait, can I guess what it is?
Sure.
Is it Flow?
Yeah, obviously. It's not going to be Juror number two. it's going to be Flow. This is a fantastic movie that all of the things we've been talking about with this movie are present in Flow. Flow is a dialogue-free film about animals trying to survive an apocalyptic flood that is happening on their world. It's unclear whether or not this world is Earth or a different world. There's other stuff, but it's just such a fun movie. It has great music, incredible sequences, a lot of really great scenes of the main character, which is a cat, trying to escape the rising waters. It is just so compelling, so well done. It's kind of like playing one of those video games that are basically just like watching a movie, like Journey, or what was the one I just played, Abzu. It's kind of like that, but you know, instead of playing it, you're just watching it. But those things have very little gameplay anyway, so it doesn't matter. But it's really well done. I'm so excited for this team to cook up another movie. They put up a statue for the cat in Latvia, where the movie is from, because it won, I believe, the first Oscar ever by a Latvian movie. So they love it over there in Latvia. I can't wait to visit someday and talk to everyone about Flow. But it's a great movie. You really should see it if you haven't. You should rent it, buy it, give it a watch.
Wow, very interesting. Isn't that movie made in like Unreal Engine or something?
It is, and one guy does like 30% of everything in the movie. Like the credits are 30% one dude, where it's like director, animator, story by. He did a lot of work. But yeah, it's Unreal Engine, which is crazy because it looks very good. It doesn't look like incredible, but I mean, it's really well done.
Well, just more video game connections.
Yeah.
That's great. I have been meaning to watch that movie for so long now, just haven't gotten around to it. So I can't second it, but all indications point to that being a very strong movie. My recommendation is going to be The Fox and the Hound. I chose it both for the obvious stylistic overlap, in that this is another cel animation movie, but also because it addresses very similar themes to The Land Before Time, at least in terms of, right, not being racist against foxes or hounds or whatever. The importance of getting along with people who are different from you.
Yeah.
I think that the Fox and the Hound, I watched it, or I guess rewatched it. I didn't remember any part of it, but I'm told that I've seen it before. But I watched it after I watched Land Before Time. And first of all, Kurt Russell plays the dog in his elder years, which is interesting. But I feel like it almost, well, I would say, yeah, it does it a little bit better than Land Before Time, because of course this concerns a relationship between just two, I was going to say people, entities. There's only two sides of this relationship, so obviously that gives it a lot more breathing room to dig into it and just make it more satisfying. And yeah, it's a heartwarming movie, and the scene with the bear at the end is intense, pretty intense. But again, the bear is just, they never try communicating with him. I can only assume that they either know or believe him to be incapable of higher level thought.
Wow. Really says something. Is it as intense as the scenes with the bear in Milo and Otis?
I'd say it's more intense than those scenes. Doesn't the bear just kind of wander around in those scenes?
Well, they couldn't show the other scenes they shot with the bear.
I thought you were going to ask me if it's more intense than the bear scene in
The Revenant.
The Revenant. Yeah.
That's an intense scene.
It is. Although, I have to say, these days, the CGI bear is looking a little rough.
Dang. That March of Time just be tough for people.
I know.
It was a good-looking bear at one point.
I bet if I watched Dinosaur, I'd be like, oh, this is just garbage.
I watched Toy Story some time ago, and I was like, ooh, some of this is not looking too hot.
That's why VeggieTales is just veggies. It's a lot less horrifying. A
lot less work. That's so true. Anyway, Elliot, do you want to say your little line here before we
the outro? I was waiting to hear if you were going to second that recommendation or not.
Oh, I can't say whether or not I would second it. I can't really remember that movie well enough to say, but certainly your description of it sounds like I would second it, so sort of.
Well, life is hard. Life is full of disappointments.
That's so true. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Like I mentioned at the top of the hour, we've got a lot of fun stuff coming up. We're excited to do our year recap episode. We're excited to do our best of all movies made pre-1959. So all, however many years of history you want to say, I'm not going to say how many years of history that is, but you know, since the dawn of human intelligence, I suppose. We're going to be putting together our list. We're really excited for those episodes, still working on them. And yeah, we'll be.
When does geology become history? That's the question.
Wow, good question, Elliot. But yeah, we're very excited for those. We're going to be back next week with another brand new episode. Might be a review, might be one of these special episodes, but look forward to that. We'll keep bringing you updates as the Oscar season builds up. I'm very excited for that. I love the Oscars. And we hope you have a great week, and we'll see you next week.